Hello, I'm Charlotte Armitage and this is Objects.
In this episode, I'm speaking to Scottish Comedy Award winner Gary Meikle. Gary was born and raised in Glasgow. Expelled from school when he was 14 years old, Gary was taken to live in a children's home before being asked to leave the day before his 16th birthday. Shortly after, Gary became a parent to his daughter Ainsley, who he raised as a single father. Gary uses comedy to share the loving and at times challenging relationship he has with Ainsley. His sketch on his daughter's obsession with her eyebrows earned him the nickname the Eyebrow Guy, and he has since gained over 150 million views and counting on social media. Gary is now an internationally known stand-up comedian who uses his platform to highlight the struggles care-experienced people face, particularly after leaving care. As someone who also experienced great difficulty when leaving care, I was immediately able to relate to and connect with Gary's story. Gary, thank you so much for joining me on Objects.
Thank you for having me.
I'm sure many people will know you from your current tour, The Eyebrow Guy, but for listeners who don't know you, can you tell me a wee bit about yourself?
Yeah, I am basically a full-time Scottish professional comedian now. I've been doing that for about 5.5 years, maybe I've been professional for about a year and a half. I then decided to use social media about 10 months ago and had a little rant about my daughter's eyebrows, and since then everything has just went absolutely crazy, and that's just kind of pushed me into the limelight, and once that happened I've just jumped on it. Instead of sitting back and going, alright, well that was just a good video, I'm happy with that, I've just every single day, I've never worked so hard to be honest, just to keep it and maintain it going, and yeah, it's just changed my life to be honest.
And the reason that we met is because I saw your video that you posted about going back to the care home that you grew up in.
Yeah.
So that's the reason that we wanted to invite you to be a guest of our show of Objects. Mm-hmm. But before we start with your Objects, I just wanted to ask you, how did you find it? How did the process of finding your Objects go for you?
Well, I'll be honest, it was probably over the last couple of weeks I've had a couple of fleeting memories kind of come back to me. The one from before, I always knew I was going to use because that was a picture. And I don't know, I think it's crazy because I never really think much about my time being in care. Ever since I left there, I've never thought about it. The only times that I have really properly thought about it was when I put the video out that you saw. Some things, I'll see things in throughout my life and it'll maybe flash back to a memory back to when I was a child. But I've never actually sat down and spoke to anybody about it. It's never been something that I've discussed with any of the relationships I've ever had with anyone. It's always something that I've, don't get me wrong, I've mentioned it, I've never had it, but I've never went into it in depth and kind of analysed it for myself. I've just kind of put it on a back burner.
So this is all very new for
you? Yes, very new, very new, very, very, very new.
So spoke very briefly there, said that your first object's a picture.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell me more about that?
Yeah, the picture. It was a picture taken at my 8th birthday party. I really wish I'd brought it now, but I can send you that later. So, yeah, the picture was a picture of me and my two best friends. It was Ola Bushla Oak and Michael Young, and it was a picture of the three of us at McDonald's on my 8th birthday party. And that was taken, probably... I don't think I ever can remember being so happy and not having any worries in my life. Don't get me wrong, I'm happy now, but when it comes to my childhood, that just picture, when I look at it, I love living in London. We lived down there from I was 5 until I was 10 years old, because my mum met stepdad number 3 out of 5 when I was 5 years old, and he was Irish, so for some reason we moved down to London, I don't know why. And we moved to London, and that was the best 5 years of my life. I loved living in London. I really, really enjoyed it. I made loads of different pals. I fit in because London's very multicultural. Anyways, you could probably tell with the names like Ola Bushla Oak, he was a Nigerian lad. Michael Young was Korean. So the three, it was like three different continents we were from, but we were best pals and we just gelled and we got on amazing. And that was just the time of my life in London. I loved it. So many good memories from then.
So you lived in London for 5 years, but you obviously came back to Scotland.
Yeah.
What was the process of that?
Yeah, well, Mum decided she'd get fed up with stepdad number 3 out of 5. He was actually quite a violent, angry man, so that kind of ended. And then when I was 10, my mum's mum, so that would be my gran, basically seen an article in the newspaper about my dad, my real dad. And my mum then contacted him and basically set up to see if I wanted to see him. So he came down to London, and that was the first time I met my dad, when I was like, just before I was 10, I think. And then we ended up moving back to Scotland within the next few months after that. Not, my mum and him didn't get back together, and I don't think he had anything to do with me coming back home to Scotland, but yeah, so that's, we came back to Scotland and then started a relationship with my dad as well.
That must have been traumatic.
It was exciting. It was really exciting, because when I came back, my dad had a bit of money.
Okay.
So he ran his own entertainment agency, Ken Meikle Entertainments, and so it was, I was just kind of propelled into this. Apart from coming back to Glasgow, and I now had a London accent, so I didn't really fit in Glasgow, to be honest. But with my dad, I was just, my eyes were opened in terms of, like, it was just different. Like, if once, like, somebody was buying me all these things and taking me to all these places, and, oh, cause, you know, I mean, it was strange, but it was amazing, it was really good, but it didn't last long. It didn't last long at all. Pretty much, basically what happened was, because I was staying with him every, maybe second weekend, and me and myself, I wanted to go and live with him. I didn't hate my mum, I didn't not go on with my mum, but this opened my eyes to a full new life, and I was like, oh my God, this is my dad, and I've actually got my dad in my life, I want to be with him. And I ended up going to live with him when I was 11 and a half. So he lived in East Kilbride, but when I went to live with him and I started getting into secondary school, I started getting into trouble, he couldn't handle it. And I mean, like, see, when I say getting into trouble, I mean, like, getting punishment exercises for maybe forgetting my PE kit or something. It wasn't, like, big, massive things. And he used to sit me down with a list. Like, he would sit, I remember one day he came downstairs and he had this big white robe on, and he's got this list, and he's going, okay, Gary, so this is what you've done wrong. And I knew in my head, even though I was only like 11 years old, I'm going, this is no way to speak to a child, this is not the way you're meant to do it. And he gave me into trouble. Yeah, because I now had a London accent, because obviously I lived there for 5 years, but in East Kilbride, in order to fit in, I changed my accent automatically to being Glaswegian. Mm-hmm. So when I was out with my friends in East Kilbride and I was at school, I was speaking Glaswegian. Then when I went home to my dad's, I was speaking London accent, and my dad found out about this, and he gave me into proper trouble for it. He's like, your London accent is fine, it's perfect. Which I thought was quite weird for a Glaswegian man as well, wanting me to keep that accent, but anyway. And he proper went through me about that. He's like, you will speak your London accent wherever you go. Don't fake a Glaswegian accent and all that. And, just loads of little things he would give me into trouble for. So anyway, I ended up, my sister came over to visit me one weekend in East Kilbride. She came over, and my dad's wife, it was called Carol, I'm going to swear a little bit, she was a cow, she didn't like me at all. She gave me and my sister into trouble for running up the stairs with her shoes on, because it was snowing outside, and we got snow over the carpet, and she shouted and bawled at us. So my sister's like, you're coming home, you're not staying here. She was just looking for an excuse, so she missed me, she wanted me to come home. So I ended up going back home to my mum. I think I lasted about another 6 months there, and I went back to my dad's again. But when I went back to my dad's this time, he said, if your mum doesn't take you back, you're going into your children's home. My mum did take me back, but at this point in my life, I think I was about 12, nearly 13. I knew that, I know my mum loved me, but I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. I didn't feel like I was wanted. And so I pretty much engineered my own way into your children's home. Just started getting into trouble. The relationship with my mum kind of further broke down, and that was it. And then social workers came out and with the police. I wrecked my room one night. That was the ultimate line. I was 12 years old. I can't remember what it was about. I can't remember how the argument started, but I ended up getting into my bedroom and I kind of shut the door, bolted it up so my mum couldn't get in, and I put on a pair of Doc Martens, just like the ones you've got on, and I destroyed my bedroom. Like, I jumped through my bed, I pulled the wardrobe down, I jumped through that. I ruined everything in my bedroom except from a little model toy kit that I built myself with little matchsticks, because I love that, and I was not breaking it. It took me weeks to build. So yeah, I wrecked everything in my room. My mum called the police, they called the social workers, and that's when I was taken to Loch Garry and the children's home.
So that's, yeah.
Yeah.
But back, in the space of a couple of years, you've went from having the happiest time in London to being pinballed back and forth
completely.
Your mum and dad.
I was always the new kid, see, wherever I went. Like, we lived in Springburn up until I was five. And then obviously we moved into London. When I moved into London, I managed to fit in there. And I think that's an age thing, though, because when you're 5 years old, you don't really have big chips on your shoulder, or you can't, you know, any argument with people for the sake of it. And I just got on with everyone down there. But then when we moved back when I was 10, We went to Kingsway Court. It was a high-rise flat. I didn't like it at all. Obviously, I was massively bullied, and I mean, like, massively from the schools. I was expelled from five different schools. But I never, for what we called back in Glasgow back then, dogging it, which means something completely different now.
Yeah.
But back then, it meant truanting. So it was just like... But the thing is, because I dogged it because I was bullied, but I was too embarrassed to tell my mum or my dad or anybody. So I just kept it and I bottled it up inside and I was massively bullied, man. I remember one guy called, I won't say his name for legal reasons, first name was Grant. He was in the year above me, so it was, I was in first year, he was in second year, and he was a huge unit of a guy. And it was because of my accent, that's what it all was about, just because I had a London accent. And in front of the full school, I don't know why there wasn't any staff there, but it was in the canteen. I was sitting at my table eating myself. And then he came over and he pinned my head against the table and he pulled a full can of Coke over my head. And I remember everybody just howling me laughter. And like, obviously I've kind of managed to escape and run out, and I just never went back to that school. Just dogged it from then on in. But yeah.
It's quite sad that something that London having such a big significance and it being your first object, because it made you, reminded you of happier times, and it's actually led to all these incidents of bullying and the going back and forward from your mum and dad, and the ultimately
care.
So on that reflection there, what do you think the impact of that period, which is obviously quite a big period of time, has had on your life now as an adult?
Huge. I've got massive rejection issues, and not just because of the bullying, just ever since then. Even whenever I moved around, I just never fit in, and because I've moved around that much, I was always the new kid at the new school. And I think I've got, but I don't think, I know I've got massive rejection issues. I've only had one long-term, I mean, I'm 42 now, I've only had one long-term relationship. The rest of them have never lasted any longer than 3 months, more often than not, a couple of weeks. And then it's because of the rejection issues. What I do is, and I know this is, I was speaking to my friend about this recently, actually, he thinks I should go and speak to somebody about it, because whenever I meet somebody, and I think it's got, and I really like them, doesn't matter how much I like them, I look for faults, and I think I do that so I can escape, so I can, like, I can be the one that backs out first. I don't want to be rejected. I can't handle being rejected, so I'll look for minuscule things in order for me just to go, no, they're not the person for me, so I can then walk away from that situation. And even so much so now that I very rarely get involved with anyone. I just don't. I've had maybe one date in the last 7 months, and I just don't, and it's not like I'm shy opportunities now because of the social media thing. I get up with quite a lot, and I'm just like, no, I'm too busy, and I am too busy, do you know what I mean? But I think if I meet somebody, and then there's an automatic spark there, then I would definitely pursue it. But I'm very, very cagey, and I think the older I'm getting, the more that gap's actually getting bigger. Because I'm just like, no, I'm happy myself, I don't need...
So it's actually quite sad then that this picture obviously represents a massively happy part of your life, but it's also left like a massive barrier being put up for you.
Yeah.
And that's had an impact now.
Yeah, 100%.
How many years on?
100%.
So, Gary, you've already briefly touched on going into care. You spoke about it when you were talking about living with your dad. So... we're going to explore your second object now, and that's the object that represents your time during care. So what is your object?
It's aftershave. My mum bought me aftershave for my 15th birthday, and that was the first thing she'd bought me for a couple of years. And I remember being pure proud of it. It was probably cheap as anything aftershave. It was called Dracon Noir. I don't know how I can remember that, I've no idea, but yeah, it was definitely Dracon Noir. And it was like four or five different little bottles. So a tiny little bottle of aftershave, then you had like body wash, you know, just a kind of a little set. And it was black and red. And I remember like when she got me it, and I was just over the moon, and I'd sat it on my bedside drawer in the children's home. I was just dead proud of it, and I'd like proper placement, kind of had it like perfect on my bedside cabinet. But then within about 2 or 3 days, somebody had stole it. And I felt, and it was obviously somebody else in the children's home, another kid. Or maybe it might have been a member of staff, I don't know. But I remember feeling just an overwhelming sense of fucking... So sorry. I remember feeling an overwhelming sense of proper betrayal. Like, these were the... I'd been in care for maybe 2 years at that point. Everybody in there I loved. It was all my best pals. And then for somebody to steal the first thing that my mum had bought me since I'd been in there, it was just, oh, that ripped me apart. And I kind of went, I wouldn't say that was the ultimate reason why I went on a downward spiral, but that was one of the catalyst things that I just, because I remember going around every kitten's shop and I was like, do you take it? And probably went to one and search everybody's room, and it just proper, it's the first time I think in my life I felt actual betrayal, even though I'd been through so much before it. I was like, oh my God. Yeah, so that was a huge impact on me.
And so you said there was like loads of children to go through. Did you live in quite a big
My children's home had like, it was a massive house. It was actually two big old-fashioned terraces, I guess, kind of joined together. There was three different units. We had Spey, Clyde and Tweed. Tweed was the younger ones. Spey was the one I was in. It was with kind of like, I think it was like, I don't know, 10 to 15-year-olds maybe. And then you had Clyde, which was the ones for independent living, and some of the kids in there stayed in there up until they were like 18. But yeah, it was quite a busy children's home. But it was kind of free, like no doors were locked. Do you know what I mean? Nobody had, there wasn't that kind of, like a, it wasn't like a List D school or a really strict one. It was kind of meant to be like a family home. And it kind of was. That's the kind of way we felt anyway. We were all really, really close, really close. Or so I thought, until somebody stole my aftershave. I was raging.
And so you were there before, so 3 years before, 2 or 3 years before your aftershave went missing.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like before that?
Ah, brilliant, brilliant. Just, I love being in care, and I know most of, so many people have got bad experiences of it. And I had obviously some bad experiences, but I've always liked to think I've had a good outlook on life. I see things in a positive sense. I'll kind of try and get the best out of every situation. Even from when I was a child, I've been like that. I really enjoyed being in care. I love, we used to take us on holiday. I got on with most of the staff. We used to run riot, don't get me wrong. Of course we did. We used to just refuse to go to bed and kind of like just have food fights and stuff in general, kind of carrying on. But I loved it. I loved the whole experience of being in there, because I genuinely felt like I was a part of something.
Mm-hmm.
I really felt like I was a part of something, and that isn't anything that I'd had before, because I'd moved around so much.
That was what I was just about to say there. It's interesting seeing the comparison. You were talking about feeling like an outsider,
mm-hmm,
for most of your childhood, and then going into care and feeling like that was gone.
Yeah.
Do you feel like this has had a good impact on you then, being in care?
I think so. I think it's taught me a lot of things. I think being in care has definitely taught me that I'm important, that if I'm going to do well in life, if I'm going to progress, and basically that I'm number one. And I know that sounds dead selfish, but I've got to look out for me. It taught me how to look after myself. Before I went into care, I was a little busy. I really was. But getting into care taught me how to handle myself. It taught me how to stick up for myself. And it just kind of, because I knew from the minute I went in there, I was alone in the sense that I didn't have any blood connections, right? But I suppose I kind of hope Harper's back to that as well, the whole kind of sense of being a part of something. I forgot where I was going. I lost my train of thought.
It's okay. So you were part of something, and did you get to stay in care then for a long time?
Well, until the day after my 16th birthday. I was pretty much kicked out, which was a massive blow as well. Because I had it in my mind that I was going to go up to the Clyde unit,
mm-hmm,
and I was going to stay up there until I was 18, because I think that's how long they kept them for until then. Not everybody, but they could. You had that option. But then that was a sense of betrayal as well, because I thought I got on, and I know it was down to the staff at the end of the day. It wasn't down to, as much as it ultimately would have been down to social workers, but that would have been based on the feedback given from all the staff that worked in there at the time on how my progress was, what my behaviour was like. So, and I thought I got on with most of the staff, so for then me to be told pretty much, and I don't remember how much notes I was given, but it was the day after my 16th birthday, I was pretty much told, right, that's where you're going, and I was put into a hostel, and that really had a massive impact on me, because I was like, no, this is my family, this is where all my friends, this is where everybody is. I've been so happy the last couple of years. I was planning to go upstairs into the Clyde unit, where you can get like, they kind of give you like the money to go and buy your own food and stuff, just kind of teach you to be a bit more independent, but you've still got the support. And then from all of a sudden just having that ripped away from me, and now you're going to stay in a hostel where you don't get any support, that was huge. And it was, again for me, a massive betrayal, because I just knew, I was like, well, the staff don't like me that much, why do they want me away? Why don't they let me go upstairs?
It sounds like what you're saying is that, so care was overall quite a good experience, mm-hmm, but it sounds like there was a lot of people letting you down actually throughout that experience, yeah. And then it ended in a letdown. What was that experience?
I've never thought about
like,
that until this conversation.
Sorry.
No, it's all right. It's good.
What was that experience like? What was it like to be put into a hostel the day after your 16th birthday?
Devastating. Absolutely horrible. I mean, you know, you're 16, you're not an adult. You're not an adult at all. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't speaking to my mum at that point. I hadn't spoken to my dad for years. I didn't have anybody. I didn't have any friends or family in the outside world at all. So then the only friends and family I had were in the children's home. So then to have that completely ripped away from me, and even to the point where I think I'd been in the hostel, I think I lasted like 3 or 4 days in there, and I just left. I just went homeless, I ended up sofa surfing for a couple of months after that. People have no idea who they were. I remember even going back to the children's home, going back to Ilsa, and they wouldn't even let me inside the home. Do you know, I had to stand outside, and like the kids would come out to speak to me, and it was devastating, horrible, horrible experience, which I've also blocked out until now. That was horrible, really bad. And that's had a huge impact, it must have.
I was just about to ask that, and do you think that you've obviously blocked it out, as you said, but mm-hmm. do you feel like reflecting on it now? Do you think, looking throughout your life, do you think that moment has had an impact on throughout your life?
Yeah, definitely, because again, that was a situation where I've been kind of thrust into it, and again, but those couple of years that I was in there, I was feeling comfortable, I was feeling like I belonged again and I was a part of something, and then all of a sudden just to get that ripped away from me without my control was, that's pretty big, isn't it? That's, mm-hmm. Especially at that age, man, I'm 16 years old. Don't have any, and you would have liked to think that the staff would have taken everything into consideration. They obviously knew at that point, they must have known you, they did know that I wouldn't have any contact in the outside world at all. So for them to then go, and again, it must have been their decision. It can't have been the social works. Even the social works maybe made the ultimate decision. But, like, and I can't even remember if, like, obviously I was on the section 44-1B, if that automatically ended when you were 16, or, because I don't remember being told that I wasn't on it anymore, and I certainly didn't get any aftercare help at all. None whatsoever.
So how did that, what did you do? How did you come from that to where you are now? Like, what process went in there?
Yeah, I was homeless for a couple of months. Just, like I said, sofa surfing, staying with different people that have no idea who they were. You know, it's like that. He's just going and getting drunk and smoking weed and just doing all sorts of different sort of things. And then I did manage to get into a hostel, I think, when I was 17, called DePaul on West Princess Street in Maryhill. It wasn't run by nuns, but the main woman was a nun, Margaret, I remember her. I was taken in there, and that was really good for me. It was quite similar to the children's home in the terms that I think a lot of the kids that were in there, there wasn't any like proper, nothing against drug addicts or anything, but it was mostly kids that had been from care that were put in that hostel. And so it was more a sense of, right, these kids have already been through something that I've been through, we've got something in common. And I stayed in there for about 6 months, and that's when, no, about a year actually, and that's when I went to a party one night and had sex with Ainsley's mum. And and that's how Ainsley came about. She's obviously my daughter, she's 24 now. But the day she was born, I jumped, me and her mum, kind of, we didn't get in a relationship. We jumped around in the same group of people, though. She was in a hostel, which was down the end of the road. And the day my daughter was born and I held her in my arms, I'm like, no, I need to make a go of this. So then I moved out the hostel and I moved in with Ainsley's mum. We lasted about 15 months. And then she basically walked out on her daughter. And then it was down to me and the granny on Ainsley's mum's side to raise Ainsley after that. So that's, Ainsley pretty much saved my life, I think. I really do. I'd like to think that I would have been sensible enough to have made a go of my life anyway after that, but I don't know. But Ainsley definitely kept me grounded. She was my reason for not going out and doing loads of drugs and not becoming a write-off, I guess.
So it sounds like actually Ainsley was that conclusion of your care, like, journey almost.
Yeah.
So your care journey will continue to go on for the rest of your life, but mm-hmm. for that definitive part, that's where it stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that actually leads us on quite nicely to your final mm-hmm. object, representing aftercare where you are now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to tell us a bit about
that?
Yeah,
so the after one, I've got on my arm here and my inner elbow. Is that what you call that, your inner elbow?
I have no idea.
For the listeners, see your elbow is just on 180 degrees on the other side. So yeah, that little crease in there, I've got a tattoo that just says 44 1B, and that was the section that I was put under when I was in care. Because when I was in care in the beginning, I was put in a section 15, which was a voluntary order, which meant that my mum, essentially, if she wanted, she could have taken me home at any point. And I was on that for like the first 6 months I was in there. So maybe the first couple of months that I was in Lochgarry, and then I was transferred to Ailsa. So even the first few months that I was in Ailsa, I was still in a section 15, but all the other kids that were in there were on a section 44 1B. And it was kind of like, because I was in the section 15 and they were all on a 44 1B, I felt different. I still felt like that outsider a little bit. Even though I still got on with them great, I was still like, no, I want to be on a section 44 1B. And I'll never forget the day we went up to the children's panel. My mum was there, my sister was even there. There was like social workers, obviously the panel and everybody else. And that's when the decision was made that, and at this point I wasn't talking to my mum or my sister, and that was the first time as well that I'd actually spoken proper Glaswegian in front of my mum. Like, see, up until that point I'd always had that London accent that I put on between her and my dad. So I was still always very respectful to my mum and my dad. I never swore at them, I never done anything. It was always outside, I was a little bit of a tow rag, but not much. But yeah, that was the first time I was like, nah, this is the way I speak now, this is the way I talk, and that's it. Because I remember my mum and my sister being quite shocked when they heard me speak. But then the ultimate decision was that, yep, Gary's not going home and he's going to stay and he's getting put on the section 44 1B, and it just felt amazing because I was like, yes, I can go back to the children's home now, tell them all that I'm on the same section as them, and it's like I'm owned. I know it's a weird thing to want to be owned by the government, to want to have that kind of stamp and that label, but I guess I suppose some people have got that when they went to jail, and it's that kind of whole camaraderie thing that just you're all on the same level. And yeah, so that meant a lot to me. That was like, yes, acceptance.
So when did you get this tattoo?
I only got this tattoo like 2 months ago. Because for the first time in my life, because I'm starting to make a little bit of money now, I was like, I can treat myself. So my daughter's getting most of the money, she's spending it all. But I was like, no, I've been treating myself to get loads of tattoos. So that was the main one that I knew I was going to get, that section.
How long have you known that you were wanting to get that tattoo?
Oh, forever. I always knew I was going to get the tattoo, because I've always wanted tattoos, but I've just never had the money. But yeah, I always knew that was going to be the main thing that I wanted on me.
So this is a big part of you and your journey,
mm-hmm.
not just your care journey, but just in life.
Yeah.
You've managed to carry that with you, even though you said already that you blocked out quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You've now got that permanently with you.
Yeah.
It's quite symbolic.
It is, and I think it's kind of, do you know what, it's in a weird sense, I'm kind of proud that I come from a care background. I suppose some people might kind of think that's quite weird, but I'm proud of it. It makes me...
I don't think that's weird. I think that's amazing. It's really inspiring to see.
I kind of feel proud. It's kind of like I wouldn't say I'm a badge of honour, but kind of like I've proved that it doesn't matter, even though I've been through really tough circumstances, I've come through the other end and I've made a success in my life. And obviously being in care has been a massive part of that, because I mean, at that age, you're moulded in a way, aren't you? That's when you do lots of your, I don't know, it's just, I'm really proud of it.
And do you think you've always felt that way?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. I always knew I was going to get this tattooed on me. And as much as I don't think about it a lot in my mind, it's never something that I've never been ashamed about it. I suppose, in a weird kind of way, I know it makes me a little bit more interesting as well.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, I've got a backstory. I've got this part of my life that was different from other people. But it doesn't make it any less special than anybody else's. It was my life. It was normal to me. I didn't see it as people might think it's really, really strange. But then it was normal to us because we went through it. We lived it.
And do you think at every stage since Ainsley was born, do you feel like this section 41B, 44B?
44 1B. Yeah.
Do you think that's had like defining pits throughout it? So when you see your journey and you turn into a young adult that's a parent, like. Mm-hmm. You're obviously now a successful comedian, but mm-hmm. in between that, there's been the getting there and the...
Oh, completely. I mean, it's not been an overnight process either. It's taken me a long time to get, a clear mind. Like, especially in my 20s, I was kind of a bit of a drinker. I said in the video, I've always known, and I have always known in the back of my mind that I was going to be successful at something. I always knew... I've always had that grit and determination that I've known. I just never knew when. I didn't know what it was going to be, but I've always had this underlying belief that I was going to be all right. There's always been a lot. And I've been surrounded by bad environments. Even after I left care, all the groups and the gangs that I hung around with, everybody, not one of them was a good environment. And I'm not saying they were bad people, they've obviously had their own issues that were going on, and they've obviously got their own experiences from their childhood that I had no idea. Do you know what I mean? Everybody's fighting their own battles, but I always knew I was going to get away from that. I always knew that one day I was going to pull away from it. And it's never been an over... Obviously, it wasn't going to be an overnight thing. It was a gradual thing. Especially the older Ainsley got. Mm. She started to ask questions. That's kind of when I stopped drinking as much as well. When Ainsley got to, like, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, she started asking a lot of questions, and I was like, right, I need to buck up my ideas here and start kind of trying to think about my future. And then I went to... Then I went into... that's when I started, because I never used to work either. I would go from job to job. I'd maybe work about 2 days a month. I'd work for agencies, and I would just end up just not going back, just living on the brew.
So did you always know, you say that you always saw success in your future, did you always know that you wanted to be a comedian?
No. I'd always loved comedy. I used to love watching Lee Evans. Lee Evans was my first big kind of comedy hero, him and Billy Connolly. Lee Evans was the one that I would watch over and over and over, and I mean over a period of years I would watch his DVDs. Even though I knew it was coming, I'd still laugh. And when I looked at it, I always remember I'd watch him on stage and I'd be like, oh my god, I loved it. I never thought I would do it, never in a million years. So when I was watching it, I didn't think I'm going to try that, but I do remember thinking, oh, how good would that be to have, like, so many people laughing at you? But I never ever in a million years thought I would do it. Never. It wasn't until I went to work for Buchanan, Clark and Wells when I was like 28, 29, and I stayed there for like 9 years. So that was the longest job I ever had, and it was a debt recovery agency. And in between calls, I'd been there for like 7 years before I discovered I had Microsoft Word. And I remember, I know this is touching so much of a technophobe, man. And I said to my mate next to me, I was like, I've got Microsoft Word. And he's went, Gary, we've all got it. You've always had it. I was like, well, nobody told me. So I started doodling in between calls and writing, and I was a part of the social committee at that point in the work. So it was my job to send out like a big notice to the bulletin board every week, like with the weekly lottery numbers and what events are coming up. And I started just writing funny things in between this. And then I was starting to get emails off of people in the work going, Gary, that was dead funny. And that kind of gave me, I was like, oh, really? All right, cool. And that's when it started to grow. I was like, oh my God, can I actually write funny material? And then what, one page of A4 just turned into like... this is on the Microsoft. One page turned into like 20 pages, and I was like, right, maybe I could be a comedy writer. And I kind of done a bit of research and maybe like who I would go about kind of sending this to people. I didn't really get anywhere, so I thought, you know what, why not just get up and try it myself? And that's what I done. I found a local open mic night and done it at Woodlands Road called The Halt Bar. I went on, done 5 minutes. I got one laugh in that 5 minutes. But that one laugh, there was only like 17 people there, so it was just like a little pub. But that one laugh was enough for me to go, oh my God, that was amazing. And then that was it, and I just put everything into it, and I knew then and there that was my passion. Mm. It was like, right, I have found something I'm passionate about. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
And you're now, you were talking about going to America.
Going to America. I've got a 6-week tour coming up in August. I've sold out 3/4 of the old concert hall, which is happening on Friday the 2nd of August. That's the day before we fly to America. I'm touring all over the world, man. We're doing a European tour. I'm going to Australia next year. It's just crazy.
And what a turnaround from that photo, from your first object.
Yeah.
You've been in London and you've gone through all these experiences, and now you're established, you're successful, and people want to hear you. That's a massive turnaround.
That is.
So you've just spent however long reflecting back on your entire journey, actually, there. Do you think there's anything at any stage that you wish you would have had?
I wish I would have had?
Yeah, is there anything that you wish you had?
The ability to do it sooner. I wish it didn't take me so long before I found my passion. I wish I'd have searched a little bit harder. As much as I like to think I'm a determined, strong-willed guy, I clearly spent a lot of years just going through a process of always knowing that I was going to be all right, but never actually taking any action and just kind of going through the motions. And that process obviously has taken me, the best part of 20 years. So I suppose if I could change anything, I wish I'd have done that sooner. But then in saying that, if I had have done that sooner, if I had tried comedy when I was 20, it might have failed, and then I might not have gone back to it again. So everything does happen for a reason. I do wish that I didn't waste so many years just plodding through. And I wouldn't say doing nothing. I was obviously raising Ainsley, and obviously all those years was a process and me kind of learning getting more mature and finding myself. But yeah, if anything, I wish that would have been a bit quicker, I guess.
But you're here now.
I'm here now, man. Yeah, I'm here now.
I
feel like my life's just started. I really do.
I must feel like that.
it's everything's very surreal just now.
No, it's really inspiring as a keen experience person to be sat in front of you just now.
Oh, thank you.
Listening to it. Well, that's actually us drawing to the end of our podcast. You just went through the process of objects. You've been a guest. And we'll be posting this, obviously. But before we go and before we finish, I'd like to hear what you would say to other care experience people who are potentially thinking about being a guest of Object. Have you got any words of encouragement?
Yeah, I didn't have an answer for this question before this interview podcast thing. Now I do. I would certainly suggest doing it because it opens up parts of your memory that you maybe that have laid dormant for a while. And it's actually speaking to you just now has helped me kind of understand a few things. For example, how much of an impact. Like me getting kicked out of class. I've always thought of care, and it was a brilliant experience, but the fact that I didn't get any support after it, and how I've forgotten about that. I just kind of put that in a back burner, so that's now something I can maybe go away and think about, and it's kind of brought up a few issues that I will go away from here today and actually think about. So it's done that for me for a start, which is amazing, because I think that's something we all need to do, is go through a process, especially about your past, and just work through it and talk through it. So for that reason alone, it's definitely worth coming and doing.
No, it's really nice to be a part of that.
Yeah, man.
Thank you so much.
No, thanks for having me, Charlotte. Thank you.
A guest of Objects, and everybody, I'm sure I'll see you very soon. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.